Welcome to WDET's special live coverage from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island during the Mackinac Policy Conference, the one time each year that politicians and business leaders, philanthropy and media all go north to get away from work and their families to sit around and talk about Michigan and its challenges and its opportunities and maybe to come up with solutions that we wouldn't come up with if we were back at home doing all the things that we normally do. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I will be with you today and tomorrow from 9 to 10. We will also have coverage from 11 to noon both of those days from right here in the dining room, talking to all the business and political and philanthropic leaders. We want to start today with someone I have known for an awfully long time, and this is going to be the last time she's here as an elected official here in the state of Michigan. Debbie Stabenow has been a U.S. Senator since 2002, I believe, was the first year she was elected. She has decided that she's not going to seek re-election this year. Debbie, it is always great to see you.
Thank you.
It's especially great to see you here on Mackinac. Did I get that year right? You were elected in
2002? I was elected in 2000, so I came in 2001.
Close, right.
You were close.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, so let's start there.
Yeah.
What an enormous contribution that you've been able to make in that seat for as long as you have. This is your last year. We talked about this last year when we were here, but that's a little closer. So I want to know how you're feeling about things coming to
an end. It's interesting. I'm still going to live in Michigan, so I'm not going away. I'll come back and pester you next year. I just won't be a U.S. Senator.
You'll always be welcome here.
Yeah. But I have been so blessed to have the opportunity to serve Michigan in so many capacities, from county commissioner, the state legislator, to U.S. House, U.S. Senate. What I have loved, on top of just getting things done, is getting to know every part of Michigan.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, every part of Michigan. There's so many things that are unique. There are wonderful different kinds of economies and jobs and small businesses and downtowns and agriculture and, you know, big cities like Detroit and smaller communities, UP. I mean, so that has been something that I love. And as I talk to people now, I can talk about all these things going on and people look at me and say, well, you really do know Michigan.
Right?
Like, That's true. But it is, this has always been a special conference. Yeah. I've actually been coming here since the 1980s when I was a state House member chairing the House Economic Development Committee.
Wow.
I chaired the committee, was on panels. Then I chaired the Small Business Committee and was invited to be on panels, and then have just kept coming.
Yeah. So I'm going to divulge a little personal story here. I met you for the first time. You won't remember this, I don't think. In 1994, when you ran for governor.
Yes.
Yeah. You came to the Free Press editorial board. Mm-hmm. I was a 23-year-old member of that board, and you came for your endorsement interview.
Yeah,
And I remember thinking then, wow, this is somebody who's going to end up being a much bigger public official here in the state of Michigan.
Yeah.
So it's been a long time.
Well, it's interesting. I was the first woman to ever run for governor.
Yeah,
and,
was
a state senator at the time. Narrowly lost in a primary. But I'll never forget the head of the AFL at the time said he would never support a candidate in a skirt. And so we've come a long ways
like,
from
imagine
there.
Imagine that, right?
I know. And so, but when I came into the state house, 1979, there were 8 women in the state house, none in the Senate, none statewide. And so you think about where we have come, and I'm so proud of all that. We have the leader of the state Senate is Winnie Brinks, is a woman. Governor, Attorney General, Secretary of State, women in Congress. And so it's a different place. I think we're better for it, having women's leadership in every part of our government. So
So before we went on air, you and I were talking about what you're up to in these last months in Washington, and it's actually some pretty important work.
Yes.
You have some things that you want to make sure stay in place after you leave. Talk about what those are and why they're really important to us here in Michigan.
Well, I've been leading on a number of really big projects. One we don't think about a lot is Sioux Locks. Yep. We have one lock that will allow the big barges to go through. Used to be two, one's down.
Yeah.
If that shuts down, we're really on borrowed time. If that shuts down within 6 months, you're looking at 11 million jobs gone because we can't get raw materials in, we can't get products out of the St. Lawrence Seaway or around the Great Lakes. So
I mean, you're talking about a global recession.
It's a global
that would result if that
global
lock
risk. Yeah. And so I've been leading the effort, which is not easy. I mean, we had to get a study to show it was economically important, and we had to go through all these processes. We're now at a point where I was able, with the infrastructure bill, President Biden supported putting all the money in, and then COVID hit, and supply chains went down, and the costs went up. And so we had to go back and get more money.
Yeah.
So I've now locked in going forward. It won't be done before I leave.
Right.
But I'm trying to lock all of that down so that we don't go backwards.
Yeah.
And that's true on a number of different fronts. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which I authored in 2010, is the signature way we fund meeting various needs in the Great Lakes, whether it's invasive species or water quality and so on. So I 2 weeks ago, got it reauthorized, a bipartisan bill that I put in with J.D. Vance from Ohio, and it passed out of committee to reauthorize it to 2031. And so I'm trying to make sure we're locking things down so that, because it's critical to the Great Lakes, the Sioux is critical. My passion has been community mental health, and we're transforming the way we fund it to fund it like healthcare. I'm working with the state, with the governor and the legislature to really lock down long term. We have 41 clinics now in Michigan, but we want to lock down that we have these clinics in every community as well as crisis centers, so folks aren't going to jail, they're not sitting in the emergency room. But that there's just a lot to it. And so, and the same thing in agriculture, we need a farm bill that's, we're up for a 5-year farm bill. I'm trying to lock it down. Before I was on the Ag Committee in the Senate, fruits and vegetables were nowhere in ag policy in the federal government. They had what they called different titles, 11 titles, nothing on fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
That's what we grow.
Yeah.
And so we now have a 12th title. It was a big fight and to get it, but now the farm bill and farm policy reflects what we grow in Michigan. And so I want to make sure that continues. So all the things, you know, making things, growing things, making sure they continue.
Yeah. So you're doing all of this in an environment that looks really different than what you encountered when you got to Washington in the early 2000s, which were not halcyon days, right? I mean, we were a divided nation then.
We were.
There was a very bitter presidential election in 2000, of course. But the result was really different. And the chaos that is, it really empower in parts of our government makes it harder to get things done. Talk just a little about what that environment looks like when the House of Representatives, for instance, can't even decide whether it's going to have a leader for more than 6 months.
I know. It's I've not seen anything like it before because I've always been in a situation where people came to public service because they wanted to govern. I have very different ideas. And, you know, fight it out on the ideas and negotiate it out and so on. But in the end, people wanted to get something done. Now we have a whole big group of people who just want chaos. Their goal is to stop government from functioning. So you can't negotiate with them because they don't have an incentive, because their goal is to have it not work. And so it is really different. And when you talk about 2000, Stephen, I think this is really important to say. We had a very close contested election that ended up in the United States Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
I did not agree with their decision. But the Democratic nominee, Al Gore, even though he didn't agree with it, accepted it for the good of the country.
Immediately,
he needed, it was important for our country to support our institutions. Now fast forward to what happened the last election, where instead of accepting it, we ended up with January 6th. I was there. It was not a normal tourist day with 5 officers that lost their lives and over 100 officers that were injured. And it was scary. And it's gone on. it's gone on. And so now we have somebody that not only doesn't respect the norms of elections, but has 88 felony indictments and is in court right now. We don't know what's going to happen. But in the past, if somebody had one felony indictment, there'd be a move to ask them to step down.
Yeah.
I mean, my colleague and seatmate, Bob Menendez, is in court in New Jersey because of illegal activity. And even though he's my friend, I said I thought he should step down. And here we have somebody with 88 felony indictments, and somehow that's okay.
And
so that's what I worry about. It's our, what we, you know, where's the red lines here on what's okay and not okay to be a leader of our country?
We've got a minute before we've got a break. What do you think is the thing that turns this back in the other direction? What has to happen?
I think it's very simple. We got to make sure that Joe Biden is reelected. We've got to make sure that people that support governing are in office, and we have to then, that gives permission to my Republican colleagues who know better to step out and make a change. They have to feel they can walk away from the threats, the bullying, the fear around Donald Trump. Mm. And if that happens, I believe you can begin to rebuild the Republican Party. We need two good, healthy parties. And but right now, it's sick. It's sick and dangerous. And so we got to stop that so we can turn it around.
I think it's so key to have people who are inside managing all of this, trying to get their work done while this goes on, talking openly about what it's like, how difficult it is, how chaotic it all is.
Yeah, it is. And it does not have to be that way. Anybody who says it doesn't matter for a democracy, I would suggest you visit other countries like I've had the opportunity to do. And we find out real quick that the freedom we have in America is real and we need to fight to keep it.
Yeah. Okay, Debbie Stabenow, always great to see you.
Thank you.
The last time we'll do this while you're a senator, but you'll come back and talk with us in the future.
I will come back.
Yes. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this special live coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. We'll be right back.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Welcome back to our special live coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. We are here with the politicians and the business leaders, the philanthropic leaders, and members of the media during our annual trip north to see if you put us all on an island together for 3 days, unable to get away from each other. Whether we could think about Michigan's challenges and opportunities differently, whether we might come up with solutions that we wouldn't otherwise. We are going to bring you 2 hours of coverage each day here from 9 to 10 a.m. and then from 11 to noon. I'm going to host 9 to 10 today and tomorrow. We've got other great WDET hosts with us as well. Nick Austin, who's a co-host of The Metro, will do some of the interviews, as will Russ McNamara, who is WDET's host for All Things Considered, and Shayna Roth, who is the co-host of the Mishmash podcast, is up here with us as well. I want to turn our attention now to Michigan's other U.S. Senator, Gary Peters. Gary, welcome to WDET.
Stephen, it's always a pleasure to be with you and to see you face-to-face, not just a voice on the other end of my...
I'm really trying to think of the last time I physically saw you. So
it's been a while, so it's good to see you.
Yeah, it's very good to see you.
It's good to be trapped on an island.
Yeah, right. Did you like how I phrased that? That we can't get away from each other up here. So let's start with just what your agenda is here. I always like to ask folks here. Why are you here? What do you hope to accomplish during these 3 days?
Well, I tell you one thing that just inevitably happens every time is that you're able to have good discussions with folks, as you mentioned, all across from politics to business to philanthropy. And literally, the conversations that I will have here over the next 2.5 days, if I were to try to individually try to seek out and talk to folks, it would take me months to actually make all of that happen.
Yeah.
So this is incredibly productive time. I'm able to meet with folks who have concerns about what's happening at the federal level. They have ideas, and you always walk away. Usually my staff has a lot of work to do after we walk away from these 3 days and a lot of projects to follow up on.
Yeah. What is it like right now in Washington? You're a member of the Senate, the upper chamber of the U.S. Congress. The lower chamber, the House, is in an incredible state of chaos, at least as someone who's watching from the outside, that's what it looks like. So much so that the majority can barely decide from day to day who should be leading them, who should be in charge. I'm really curious about when you're trying to get things done in the Senate, and you're somebody who tries with members of your party as well as members of the opposite party, what's that like when the other chamber is as dysfunctional as it is right now?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. So even if we are able to come together in the Senate and put together bills that have bipartisan support, they don't move. They're not moving in the House. So if you look at the actual productivity of legislation passed, this is historically one of the lowest in terms of passing bills. And it's not coming out of the Senate. It's the fact that they don't move through the House and then get to the president's desk for signature. And that's, as you mentioned, it's something that I think is a huge problem. We have to come together. We have to solve tough problems, and we can only do that together. That's what this conference is about, is how do we build those kinds of bridges to do, and you can. But if you have one of the houses of the Congress that are not working properly, it's a problem.
Does that have effects that people here in Michigan should be thinking about? I always want to make this, you know, personal, right? We send people to Washington to do our business, the people's business. What does it mean to our lives when that's not possible?
Well, things don't get done, and you wonder why is government not able to address some of the issues. I think what I'm really worried about is you see some public opinion polls. There was one that was released just recently that showed people are starting to lose faith in democracy, that democracy can't function. Mm-hmm. That is frightening to me. The alternative is not an alternative that any of us should think is even remotely something that we would desire. But in order to maintain strength in democracy, you actually have to deliver. You have to make sure that people's voices are heard, and those voices are then translated into actual action that the government is engaged in. Mm-hmm. But when you have dysfunction, particularly what we're seeing at the House, that doesn't happen. And I think, you know, ultimately, it's up to all of us as citizens to demand that our elected officials do work in a bipartisan way when possible, not compromising your principles.
Right.
We all have principles. You don't do that. But actually get things solved and not reward. Right now, the incentive system, reward system, actually rewards people who are rock throwers. It doesn't reward people who work in a bipartisan way. Present company excluded. You know, when you look at the media, I'll use cable television as an example.
Sure.
You know, if I have a bill that I've passed in a bipartisan way, got broad support, they're not going to have me on talking about
it.
They're not interested. If I want to throw a rock at whatever the news of the day is and cause some controversy, I'm on their show. And that's, to me, not what we should be focused on. You could do some of that, yes, but let's spend some time actually talking about what we're getting done, what we hope to get done, and people should hold us accountable to actually do that and to try to work in a way that accomplishes things.
Yeah, yeah. So what issues are you working on right now in Washington?
Well, the one big issue that I'm working on that we're hoping to have legislation that I'll be introducing and hopefully moving through my committee soon is in the area of artificial intelligence, AI, which is getting a lot of attention. We know that artificial intelligence offers tremendous opportunities in all sorts of fields, but it also has a lot of challenges, particularly when it comes to bias and a lack of transparency. You know, how do we manage this? Within my committee, Homeland Security and Government Affairs, I oversee the contracting process for the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be putting out legislation that will put a set of parameters and policies when the federal government purchases artificial intelligence systems. How do we manage that? How do we take advantage of opportunities while protecting folks from what could be biased and non-transparent decision-making? There's a lot of talk about how do we regulate AI in the economy at large, and that's pretty hard to do because of all the stakeholders. And my view is if the federal government is a leader in how we manage it responsibly, that will, and we purchase a lot. The federal government's a huge purchaser. The procurement process can drive business practices and how businesses approach it all across the country by looking at how we procure our services that we use to provide benefits and services to the American people.
Yeah. I know you also have a real interest in manufacturing here in Michigan and, of course, in the United States. Let's talk about the CHIPS Act and what effect it's having on us. It's still pretty new. We're still waiting, I think, to see how it pays off. But the fact that we have it is so huge.
It is absolutely. It's indispensable if you think about manufacturing today.
And this, we should explain what the CHIPS Act is really quickly. It's an effort to make more of the things that govern our lives, these little microprocessors that run our cars and our homes and everything else now, make them here in America.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do. They're in everything. The hundreds of them in your car.
Your car is a rolling computer right now.
Absolutely. Things as basic as when you push the button to have your window go down, there's a chip that does that.
Yes, that's right.
And if those chips,
it's not just a circuit anymore.
It's not. And those chips are made outside the United States, and we're dependent. To me, it's a national security issue that you want to have those essential manufactured products made in the United States with U.S. Workers so that we can't get cut off. And particularly a potential adversary like China, that you don't want to be beholden to the Chinese government for something that's absolutely critical for everything that we use here in the United States. So the CHIPS Act makes sure that those investments that are being made by private companies are made in the U.S., made here, not overseas, to make sure that we have a steady supply. And when you have the chip manufacturing here, it also spills over to all aspects of manufacturing, whether it's cars or any other kind of appliance or product that's being made. Folks want to be near their chip supply, and that'll just continue to drive manufacturing in this country.
And when you think about Michigan, of course, you'd think about manufacturing. I mean, we make stuff. We always have made stuff. This is a really key part of our future economy.
Yeah, absolutely. We make it, and when we make it in the United States, it's going to help Michigan. We have the skilled workers. We know how to do precision manufacturing better than anybody. Mm-hmm. That's why you're seeing industries like aerospace you're seeing more aerospace companies here, moving some of them from California, where it used to be a lot of aerospace, because they want to be around skilled workers who understand precision manufacturing, and that's going to be a big deal for us.
Yeah.
So securing the supply chain, as we saw with the pandemic, if you have a weak supply chain, our economy can be very, very efficient, but we see that it may not be resilient. We need both efficiency and resiliency, and the only way you get resiliency is making it in the United States.
Yeah. Talking with Gary Peters, one of our two U.S. senators here in Michigan, up on Mackinac Island in the dining room of the Grand Hotel during the Mackinac Policy Conference, our annual trip north for business, political, philanthropic, media leaders to sit around and talk about Michigan, our challenges and our opportunities, how we might think about those things in a different light. Gary, it's an election year. You're not on the ballot this year.
I'm happy about that.
I was going to say, I think anyone who's not on the ballot this year has got to be happy, but the election is affecting everything and everyone in a way that I'm not sure it always did. In a year like this, what's the role for someone like you, who's not in front of voters, doesn't have to ask the voters for their support, but certainly you've got to have concerns about just the way things are going and the way that voters relate to the people who represent them and the way that the people who represent the people govern and manage the relationships between between each other. What do you do in a year like this?
Well, I'm actually very involved this year because another hat that I wear is I chair the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee. That means my job is to hold the Senate majority and expand it. So no pressure whatsoever.
I was going to say, that's an easy gig.
Yeah, no pressure. And I did it last cycle. Normally folks don't do it twice. But, you know, last cycle we did it. Folks didn't think that would happen, especially midterm election with who's in, you know, the party in power in White House tends not to do well. But not only did we hold the majority, we expanded it. It was the first time since 1934 that mm-hmm. that happened. So my colleague said, you got to do this again. So here I am back for Act Two. You know, to your point, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of what we saw in the last cycle is here with our Senate candidates. Again, we have superior candidates, clear contrast between where the Republicans and we're going to run really strong campaigns. But to reaching out, it's about really making sure we're having those substantive conversations with those swing voters who haven't made decisions yet. And it's surprising, but there's still a good number of folks like that, particularly in our Senate races. And that's what our focus will be in the months ahead.
How worried are you about this kind of existential threat to democracy? And I never want to sound overheated about that, right? I mean, you want to keep things in perspective. But there's things happening now that none of us have ever witnessed, at least in our lifetime. And I'm always curious about the people who are part of government. How does that look from your chair? How worried should we be?
Well, I worry. And I worry one thing in particular is the fact that you have the election deniers and folks now going into this election are saying they may not accept an election outcome, even if all the experts say it was free and fair.
Right.
You know, when you think about fundamental democracy, the most fundamental aspect of democracy is that the voters vote, their vote is counted, and there's a peaceful transfer of power.
Yes.
If you take that away, democracy has gone away. It is to have some of my Senate colleagues, for example, saying they're not sure if they would accept the results of an election, that is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
It's incredibly dangerous. You're seeing it now reflected in some of the polling. And the other thing in polling you're seeing is that some more folks, unfortunately, are accepting violence if they don't get their way. We're on a very dangerous slope here that everybody needs to be aware of and understand what exactly is on the ballot this year and how important it is that we stand up for fundamental democracy.
Yeah, I keep saying to everyone that one of the keys to all of this is democratic participation. Right?
Absolutely.
Do your part.
Right.
Research the campaigns and the candidates, register to vote, and show up. It's not a solution, but it is the base from which the solution will emerge.
Absolutely.
All right, Gary Peters, always great to see you. Always great to have you here on Mackinac Island. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Stephen.
Yeah. Of the Mackinac Policy Conference on Mackinac Island. We're in the dining room of the Grand Hotel where the conference takes place. Things are just getting started this morning. One of the things that people have come to really look forward to up here on Mackinac Island is the annual address by the mayor of the city of Detroit, Mike Duggan. He has taken special advantage, really, of the stage here on Mackinac to talk in depth about the things that he faces as mayor of the city, the challenges that the city has. He's even taken the opportunity to talk about things that we've found it difficult to talk about in the past. I had a conversation earlier this morning with Mayor Mike Duggan about what his plans are for this year and what's going on with several different projects and issues in the city of Detroit. Mayor Mike Duggan, always great to see you, and especially good to see you on Mackinac Island.
Yeah, great to be here again.
Yeah. So I always start with this question. What's your plan this year? What's your agenda up here this year look like?
You know, there are so many things that are going on right now, and yesterday I was on a group that's advocating for more money for affordable housing and pushing for more money for crime prevention. And really just having a chance to talk to folks. Of course, we need to put together a plan for the Renaissance Center. Lots of conversations going on here that I think are good for the city.
Yeah. What's your address going to be like today, Wednesday?
So I'm going to be Stephen Henderson today. I'm going to interview Chief White about the way the department has been redesigned and what we're doing differently, and I think it's going to be a very different kind of experience than people in the past who have listened to my PowerPoint speeches.
Right. I mean, you've become renowned up here for really detailed presentations about what's going on in the city. What are you going to talk to the chief about?
So lay that out for the group. It is going to be a completely unexpected subject for the two of us.
A surprise.
But it'll be... not so much PowerPoint, but maybe some more video stories of what the department's doing and the way it's been redesigned and, you know, why, you know, Chief White was invited to the White House to address the chiefs nationally on the way the Detroit Police Department's been reconfigured. But you and I remember 20 years ago when the Detroit Police Department had the highest rate of shooting civilians of any department in America. It is a completely different department today, and it's a completely different kind of relationship with the community.
Yeah. That's a good place to kind of start digging in on the substantive issues that we're dealing with in Detroit. The crime rate, the numbers, the murder numbers and other violent crimes continue to go down. Of course, we still have more of it than any of us would like. What do you attribute that progress to specifically?
Well, it's been a concerted effort, but you know, you saw the numbers last year. We had the fewest homicides since 1966.
Yeah.
We're almost halfway through the year this year, and we're down another 20% on homicides. We're down more than 50% on carjackings this year. And so it's been a lot of things. The Detroit Police Department obviously is doing a great job. They're using technology well. We have more cops on the street with the pay raises. But we've had the support of Dawn Eisen and the U.S. Attorney. Warren Evans has led an effort on the county side that cleared out the backlog of those court cases. We had 3,000 accused felons of gun crimes who were not even having a day in court and were still on the street. The judges have come in. The prosecutors come in. We've cleared those kinds of things out. And now... more and more of our murders are our mental health issues. You saw the one we just had on the way up.
Sure.
Man shot and killed his nephew because he thought his nephew was part of a conspiracy following him.
Yeah.
While the rest of the family watched and the police had to respond to that, we're seeing fewer and fewer shootings related to guns and, I mean, related to gangs and drugs, and more related to just personal conflict with mental illness strain. I'm going to talk about that, too.
Yeah. The things that the department is doing with regard to mental illness are different than what we've seen police, not just in Detroit, but in other places, do as well.
There's no doubt about it. They now have completely different weapons. They've got special guns with rubber bullets. They've got bolo nets. The police department, you and I remember, 20 years ago was you shoot at mass until the threat is eliminated. And,
yep.
You know, I prosecuted four cops who shot a fellow with a rake, and the jury acquitted him because this is the way cops are trained to respond.
Right.
Now you have a police chief in a department that approaches the mentally ill. There's some cases you have no choice. You have to do. But the number of times that they are succeeding. They've got a barricaded gunman a week in the city.
Yeah.
And they got a 95% success rate of getting them out without anybody being killed, without a suicide. It's been really remarkable.
Yeah. Let's talk about population. Good news from the census. News that none of us that probably could even remember having before. It's 1957, I think, since the population has officially, at least, been going up. A lot of people say you don't deserve credit for that, that whoever's mayor just happens to be mayor when it goes up or down. What would you say is the takeaway from that?
Yeah, I don't worry too much about that, but when I ran for mayor, I would say in my speeches, you know, that I was born in 1958 and the population of Detroit has dropped every single year I've been alive.
Right.
And our measure, when I did the first State of the City speech, and this is how I want to be measured, is you should have more people want to move in and move out. You pulled me aside and said, don't make a promise that's going to be
impossible. I thought it was a terrible idea. Right.
But it was always what has been driving our overall decision. And then I opened the Washington Post this morning. The lead editorial in the Washington Post is Detroit is right at its census lawsuit. The Census Bureau has to get its act together. And so the Census Bureau had to be pretty shocked there in D.C. I have no idea how the Washington Post caught on to this, but we are right. And yeah. I've been saying it for a while, and now the argument's become so compelling that it's being recognized nationally.
Yeah. When we talk about population growth, of course, some people worry that that means a demographic change in Detroit, that the people who are coming in are whiter and wealthier than the population, and that the population has been here forever, the majority black, less wealthy population, somehow is going to suffer because of that. In other words, the priorities that city government has will change. How do you answer that
so
concern?
As you know, 200,000 people moved out of the city in the decade before I got elected. By and large, African-American middle-class families with children are the ones who left for the suburbs. And that left plenty of room in this city. You know, when you look at what happened in gentrification in Brooklyn or Washington, D.C., people of low income were forced out. In Detroit, we have not had that. We have protected the people who stayed. The people who stayed elected me, not the people who left. And so we are bringing people back, but you're seeing us renovate vacant buildings. We're renovating a vacant train station. We're renovating a vacant DPS building. We're renovating 15,000 vacant houses. And the people in this city want a neighbor on their block, and they celebrate every time one of these vacant houses gets reoccupied. And we are a city where everybody is welcome. But as you know, you've heard that argument voiced. I got reelected with 72% of the vote the next time and 75% of the vote the last time. The vast majority of the people believe that we want to build a city where everybody is welcome, everybody is valued, and I always go to work every day to work for the people who stayed.
Yeah. I ask you this every time we talk about neighborhoods and the focus on neighborhoods and whether we're doing enough to shore up places that have, you know, taken it on the chin for a really long time. Where are we with that?
Well, the University of Michigan study that came out 2 months ago that showed a $3 billion gain in black wealth and homeowners in this city and from every corner of the city. And remember my first State of the City speech, I said, don't move out yet, stay. The people who stayed have seen their wealth grow enormously. And it is exciting to see this. And now we're doing some things where it's great if you own a house, but when the property values went up, rents went up too. And so now there's a lot of pressure on folks who have stayed, and we started this down payment assistance program where we provide up to $25,000 for long-time Detroiters. You have been a renter for a year.
Right.
400 renters got converted to homeowners in the last year, 92% African-American. And this is what we wanted. The people who stayed ought to have the chance to have the ownership, build that wealth, and it's the kind of city we're building, and it's why people have responded to me really the way they have. The people of the city have just been tremendously supportive.
Yeah. I'm talking to Mike Duggan, mayor of the city of Detroit, in the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island during the Mackinac Policy Conference. Mr. Mayor, I want to talk a little about the riverfront. And, you know, I say this all the time. It is the part of the city that has changed the most in my lifetime, and for the better. I don't think anybody has questions about that. And the change is transformational. I mean, it's hard to even put into words sometimes how different it is. The latest news about the riverfront, though, is not as good. There's a budding scandal there that involves a lot of missing money. I guess my concern is the potential for that to threaten the progress. And, of course, the city has a huge stake in all this. I just want to get your reaction to what's going on and whether there's a concern on your part about
the future.
Well, there is a concern. Of course, you have every leader in this city on that Riverfront Conservancy board.
Yes.
And how this happened, I think, is still being investigated. I don't know how you have that amount of money missing and your annual audit doesn't pick it up. But the biggest project, as you know right now, is the Wilson Park, which
yes.
you just had the publicity on the huge bear slide, and David Eggener and the Wilson Foundation are pushing forward on that. What's going to be the outcome of the rest of it? I guess we're waiting to see the accounting, but the fact that I drive by every day and see the work going on in Wilson Park, I'm feeling very good about that. But you're right, the most transformational part of it is we never had one place in this city where everybody came together, no matter your age, your
That's
race.
Absolutely true.
And now you go down to that riverfront on the weekends, and everybody of every age, every shape, every size are all together. It has become the unifying center of the city.
Yeah. I mean, and that's, I guess, one of my worries is there's tremendous buy-in among Detroiters, among people who don't live in the city, among visitors. We got everybody on the same page for that, and I worry that if this gets embroiled in scandal the way so many other things in our community have, it undercuts that buy-in.
It is odd to be up at the island, and instead of having the business leaders talking about the city's finances, it's now we're talking about the Conservancy's
finances. You're getting a little break, right?
but I think Matt Cullen is on top of it now.
Yeah.
Of course, he made a $1 million donation himself. To help keep things going, which I think was a message to everybody that we may have made some mistakes here, but we're all going to pull together to fix it.
Yeah. What about the rents then? GM is leaving it. There are a lot of discussions about what's next. You know, I always feel like rather than look at things as opportunities, sometimes we look at them, we choose to see them as problems. This is an opportunity of sorts, but it's a complicated one.
So I'm deeply engaged in this. Of course, you've been the Hudson's Building was closed for 20 years before it was demolished. Train station was closed nearly 40 years before it got reused. This city has not been willing to recognize when its iconic buildings can no longer be used the way they have to get together. And so General Motors isn't a real estate firm. Barry Barr is totally focused on making vehicles. Getting Dan Gilbert to buy in was the key part of this.
Buy into the rents.
Buy into the rents, because it wasn't really Dad's area. But the fact that the Gilbert organization, Bedrock, are all the way in, we are going to pull together and find a solution. And it may look different, and it may be different uses, but we are going to face reality as it is and come up with a vibrant future. We're not going to let it sit there for 20 years and say, oh, man, there's no demand for office. The fact that Gilbert's involved, to me, was the game changer.
How does that connect to the I-375 project, which is right next door, and it all, of course, affects all of the communities around that?
Yeah, I-375 has gotten complicated for reasons that we mixed a lot of different things. But I think the fact that MDOT shrunk it from 9 lanes to 6 lanes was the right thing.
I don't see that much of as much of an improvement.
From my standpoint, 9 lanes was a huge gulf between them.
Yes.
And so I think when you raise the 375 to grade, you're going to create essentially a mile of the hottest development land in the country.
Absolutely.
In downtown. Nobody gets a mile of downtown built for them. And so if we do this right, and Antoine Bryant's leading the planning side, and then we need to have a serious conversation relative to who benefits from that land, and I think there has to be consideration given to people who are pushed out. The renters in particular in the 60s were
Absolutely.
Not compensated when they were pushed out of that area, whether you were a resident or whether you were a business. The property owners got their checks.
Yes.
Those folks got pushed out. They largely went over to the 12th Street area that
Yep.
contributed significantly to the violence in 1967. All of those things need to be a part of the conversation, but this city will benefit enormously if you create what is essentially a new mile of downtown.
Yeah. Okay, before I let you go, got to settle a debate that I've been having with our producers about Mackinac. Fudge
or taffy?
I'm a taffy guy.
Yeah, see, you're on my side. Exactly. It's way better than the fudge. I can't eat that fudge.
The tourists get out and ask, where's the best fudge? They ought to be asking, where's the best taffy?
Thank you. Thank you. That's why you're the mayor. All right. Mike Duggan, always great to talk with you. Thanks for coming by.
Great to see you.
That was my conversation with Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan here at the Mackinac Policy Conference. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by one of the other WDET hosts who's up here on Mackinac Island. Shayna Roth was here for the first time. She's going to talk about her initial impressions of the Mackinac Policy Conference at Mackinac Island and what she's up to this week. We'll be right back with more special live coverage from WDET. Coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference from the dining room of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined now by Shayna Roth, who is the co-host of the Mishmash podcast. She's up here with us at WDET, interviewing, talking to folks, and this is her first trip to Mackinac. Is that right, Shayna?
Stephen.
How is that possible?
I was always the one that got to stay behind in Lansing.
That got to stay behind,
you know,
right?
This morning I was awoken by a very loud horn from, I believe, a fairy.
Fairy.
So yeah. That never happened to me when I had to stay behind. I got to sleep in.
Right. So I'm always curious. People who come here for the first time, this is a really different kind of event. It's not comparable to other things that certainly we do as journalists. What are your initial impressions?
It's so weird here.
Weird. That's your one word answer.
It's so nuts because, you know, on the day-to-day basis, you think of particularly like Congress people, U.S. senators, of being very inaccessible. And on my way over here, I shared a shuttle bus with Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin.
Yes, right.
And you're just like,
who's a Senate candidate, right?
Right, exactly. You're like, they're just right there and they're just wandering around. It's like a weird summer camp kind of situation. We're all trapped here on this island. The Grand Hotel is a little uncanny valley.
Yeah.
I mean, all of it is just, it's such a surreal place to be. It's delightful. The weather's gorgeous.
Yes.
But
it's gorgeous. I mean, it's not always like this. You got to know that. Some years it's miserable and it's cold and you're walking through streets that are not just wet, but also messy with, you know, what the horses leave behind.
I was gonna say, so, I mean, the horse situation here is unique.
It can get that can get a little messy. So you're planning to, of course, have conversations with lots of the people here. You had one already today.
I did.
With
I got to speak
Dana
with
Nessel, our Attorney
General. I got to speak with Attorney General Dana Nessel. Always a pleasure to speak with her. We talked about, you know, her scam initiatives to get rid of, you know, to fight against all those scam robocalls, and particularly we talked about like the healthcare situation that's going on right now, where there's a lot of data breaches and stuff going on there. You know, she's an incredibly interesting interview. I always love when I have a chance to speak with her. She's just so knowledgeable and so precise. And yeah, I look forward to listeners getting to hear that whole conversation.
Yeah. Who else are you looking forward to talking to?
Well, we've got Speaker Joe Tate on the docket and Lieutenant Governor Garland Gilchrist. Those are two gentlemen that are also always very exciting to hear from. I'm especially excited to talk to Speaker Tate because, you know, we've got a budget that's hanging out there. I want to know what's going on with that. I want to know where we're at. When is that going to get wrapped up so they can do other stuff? Because they've been pretty stalled. They're just focusing on the budget right now. And there's a lot out there that I think that would be interesting for them to be working on.
I kind of feel like the budget debate has dragged longer than I anticipated that it would, and I don't know what the hang-up is.
You know, there shouldn't be a hang-up because there's, you know, they have the Democrat trifecta going on right now. And
right.
I think one of the big things was is they lost that for a little bit because they had two representatives who decided, you know, who ran and lost their
seats.
Ran
for local seats.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then they had to wait for those to get replaced.
And now they can finally come and attack the budget. And, I want to tell them. I'm like, what are you guys doing up here? Get back to Lansing. Get this thing wrapped up. There's stuff going on.
I've been here years when the budget was not done and there was almost an emergency about it. I mean, people were really anxious about it because they figured if it didn't get done here, it wouldn't get done over the summer when they're mostly gone, and then you're up against it. So
especially this year, because there's an election year.
That's
you know,
right.
They're all
going to
be
campaign.
Out. They're all going to be out campaigning. They got to get this budget done soon, yeah. Otherwise.
Okay, Shayna Roth, co-host of Mishmash. It's always great to see you. Welcome to Mackinac. Have a great first Mackinac.
I'm going to go get me some taffy.
That's right, taffy, not fudge. All right, that's going to do it for us and our special live coverage of the Mackinac Policy Conference from Mackinac Island. We'll be back at 11 a.m. with more special coverage, but next is On Point from WBUR in Boston.